And now, from his memoirs of the Second World War, Winston Churchill reads Chapter 1, 1919 to 1929, The Follies of the Victors.
After the end of the World War of 1914, there was a deep conviction and almost universal hope that peace would reign in the world. This heart's desire of all the peoples could easily have been gained by steadfastness in righteous convictions and by reasonable common sense and prudence. The phrase, the war to end war, was on every lip, and measures had been taken to turn it into reality. President Wilson, wielding, as was thought, the authority of the United States, had made the conception of a League of Nations dominant in all minds. The British delegation at Versailles molded and shaped his ideas into an instrument which will forever constitute a milestone in the hard march of man. The victorious armies were at that time all-powerful, so far as their outside enemies were concerned. They had to face grave internal difficulties and many riddles to which they did not know the answer. But the Teutonic powers in the great mass of Central Europe, which had made the upheaval, were prostrate before them, and Russia, already shattered by the German flail, was convulsed by civil war and falling into the grip of the Bolshevik or Communist Party. In the summer of 1919, the Allied armies stood along the Rhine and their bridgeheads bulged deeply into defeated, disarmed and hungry Germany. The chiefs of the victor powers debated and disputed the future in Paris. Before them lay the map of Europe, to be redrawn almost as they might resolve. Germany, the head and forefront of the offense, regarded by all as the prime cause of the catastrophe which had fallen upon the world, was at the mercy or discretion of conquerors, themselves reeling from the torment they had endured. The war leaders assembled in Paris had been borne thither upon the strongest and most furious tides that have ever flowed in human history. Gone were the days of the treaties of Utrecht and Vienna, when aristocratic statesmen and diplomats, victor and vanquished alike, met in polite and courtly disputation, and free from the clatter and babel of democracy, could reshape systems upon the fundamentals of which they were all agreed. The peoples, transported by their sufferings and by the mass teachings with which they had been inspired, stood around in scores of millions to demand that retribution should be exacted to the full. Woe betide the leaders now perched on their dizzy pinnacles of triumph, if they cast away at the conference table what soldiers had won on 100 blood-soaked battlefields. France, by right alike of her efforts and her losses, held the leading place. Nearly 1.5 million Frenchmen had perished defending the soil of France on which they stood against the invader. 5 times in 100 years, in 1814, 1815, 1870, 1914 and 1918, had the towers of Notre Dame seen the flash of Prussian guns and heard the thunder of their cannonade. Now, for 4 horrible years, 13 provinces of France had lain in the rigorous grip of Prussian military rule. Wide regions had been systematically devastated by the enemy or pulverized in the encounter of the armies. To those Frenchmen, and there were many in high authority who had fought and suffered in 1870, it seemed almost a miracle that France should have emerged victorious from the incomparably more terrible struggle which had just ended. The Kaiser's mailed fist and shining armor and speeches might be received with ridicule in England and America. It sounded a knell of horrible reality in the hearts of the French. For 50 years almost they had lived under the terror of the German arms. Now at the price of their lifeblood, the long oppression had been rolled away. Surely here at last was peace and safety. With one passionate spasm, the French people cried, never again. What prospect was there in the future that the great Allies would once again appear in their millions upon the battlefields of France or in the East? Russia was in ruin and convulsion, transformed beyond all semblance of the past. Italy might be upon the opposite side. Great Britain and the United States were separated by the seas or oceans from Europe. The British Empire itself seemed knit together by ties which none but its citizens could understand. When again would peaceful, careless, anti-militarist Britain tramp the plains of Artois and Picardy with armies of 2 or 3 million men? When again would the ocean bear 2 millions of the splendid manhood of America to Champagne and the Argonne? Worn down, doubly decimated, but undisputed masters of the hour, the French nation peered into the future in thankful wonder and haunting dread. Where then was that security, without which all that had been gained seemed valueless, and life itself, even amid the rejoicings of victory, was almost unendurable? The mortal need was security, at all costs and by all methods, however stern or even harsh. On Armistice Day, the German armies had marched homeward in good order. They fought well, said Marshal Foch, Generalissimo of the Allies, with the laurels bright upon his brow. Speaking in soldierly mood, let them keep their weapons. But he demanded that the French frontier should henceforth be the Rhine. Germany might be disarmed, her military system shivered in fragments, her fortresses dismantled. Germany might be impoverished. She might be loaded with measureless indemnities. She might become a prey to internal feuds. But all this would pass in 10 years or in 20. The indestructible might of all the German tribes would rise once more, and the unquenched fires of warrior Prussia glow and burn again. But the Rhine, the deep, broad, swift-flowing Rhine, once held and fortified by the French army, would be a barrier and a shield behind which France could dwell and breathe for generations. Very different were the sentiments and views of the English-speaking world, without whose aid France must have succumbed. The territorial provisions of the Treaty of Versailles left Germany practically intact. She still remained the largest homogeneous racial bloc in Europe. When Marshal Foch heard of the signing of the peace treaty of Versailles, he observed with singular accuracy, "This is not peace, it is an armistice for 20 years. The economic clauses of the treaty were malignant and silly to an extent which made them obviously futile. Germany was condemned to pay reparations on a fabulous scale. These dictates gave expression to the anger of the victors and to the failure of their peoples to understand that no defeated nation or community can ever pay tribute on a scale which would meet the cost of modern war. The multitudes remained plunged in ignorance of the simplest economic facts, and their leaders, seeking their votes, did not dare to undeceive them. The newspapers, after their fashion, reflected and emphasized the prevailing opinions. Few voices were raised to explain that payment of reparations can only be made by services or by the physical transportation of goods in wagons across land frontiers or in ships across salt water. Or that when these goods arrive in the demanding countries, they dislocate the local industry, except in very primitive or rigorously controlled societies. In practice, as even the Russians have now learned, the only way of pillaging a defeated nation is to cart away any movables which are wanted and to drive off a portion of its manhood as permanent or temporary slaves. But the profit gained from such processes bears no relation to the cost of the war. Not one in great authority had the wit, ascendancy, or detachment from public folly to declare these fundamental, brutal facts to the electorate. Nor would anyone have been believed if he had. The triumphant Allies continued to assert that they would squeeze Germany till all the pips squeaked, All this had a potent bearing on the prosperity of the world and the mood of the German race. In fact, however, these clauses were never enforced. On the contrary, whereas about 1,000 millions of German assets were appropriated by the victorious powers, more than 500 millions were lent a few years later to Germany, principally by the United States and Great Britain, thus enabling the ruin of the war to be rapidly repaired in Germany. As this apparently magnanimous process was still accompanied by the machine-made howlings of the unhappy and embittered populations in the victorious countries, and the assurances of their statesmen that Germany should be made to pay to the uttermost farthing, no gratitude or goodwill was to be expected or reaped. Germany only paid, or was only able to pay, the indemnities later extorted because the United States was profusely lending money to Europe, and especially to her. In fact, during the 3 years, 1926 to 1929, the United States was receiving back in the form of debt installments, indemnities, from all quarters, about one-fifth of the money which she was lending to Germany with no chance of repayment. However, everybody seemed pleased and appeared to think that this might go on forever. History will characterize all these transactions as insane. They helped to breed both the Marshall Curse and the economic blizzard, of which more later. Germany now borrowed in all directions, swallowing greedily every credit which was lavishly offered her. Thus, Germany gained the 2,000 million sterling in loans, as against the 1,000 millions of indemnities which she had paid in one form or another by surrender of capital assets and valuta to foreign countries, or by juggling with the enormous American loans. All this is a sad story of complicated idiocy, in the making of which much toil and virtue were consumed. The victors imposed upon the Germans all the long-sought ideals of the liberal nations of the West. They were relieved from the burden of compulsory military service and from the need of keeping up heavy armaments. A democratic constitution, in accordance with all the latest improvements, was established at Weimar. Emperors having been driven out, known entities were elected. Beneath this flimsy fabric raged the passions of the mighty, defeated, but substantially uninjured German nation. The prejudice of the Americans against monarchy, which Mr. Lloyd George made no attempt to counteract, had made it clear to the beaten empire that it would have better treatment from the Allies as a republic than as a monarchy. Instead, a gaping void was opened in the national life of the German people. All the strong elements, military and feudal, which might have rallied to a constitutional monarchy and for its sake respected and sustained the new democratic and parliamentary processes, were for the time being unhinged. The void was open, and into that void, after a pause, there strode a maniac of ferocious genius, the repository and expression of the most virulent hatreds that have ever corroded the human breast, Corporal Hitler. It was Niagara, France, that greeted the dawn of victory. Deep fear of Germany pervaded the French nation on the morrow of their dazzling success. It was this fear that had prompted Marshal Foch to demand the Rhine frontier for the safety of France against her far larger neighbor. But the British and American statesmen held that the absorption of German populated districts in French territory was contrary to the 14 points and to the principles of nationalism and self-determination upon which the peace treaty was to be based. They therefore withstood Foch and France. They gained Clemenceau by promising first a joint Anglo-American guarantee for the defense of France. Secondly, a demilitarized zone. And thirdly, the total, lasting disarmament of Germany. The treaty of guarantee was signed accordingly by Wilson and Lloyd George and Clemenceau. The United States Senate refused to ratify the treaty. They repudiated President Wilson's signature. And we, who had deferred so much to his opinions and wishes in all this business of peacemaking, were told without much ceremony that we ought to be better informed about the American Constitution. In the fear, anger, and disarray of the French people, the rugged, dominating feature of Clemenceau, with his world-famed authority and his special British and American contacts, was incontinently discarded. Ingratitude towards their great men, says Plutarch, is the mark of strong peoples. It was imprudent for France to indulge this trait when she was so grievously weakened. The British temper towards Germany, which at first had been so fierce, very soon went as far astray in the opposite direction. The two nations fell apart in thought and action, and British sympathy, or even admiration for Germany, found powerful expression. The League of Nations had no sooner been created than it received an almost mortal blow. The United States abandoned President Wilson's offspring. The president himself, ready to do battle for his ideals, suffered a paralytic stroke just as he was setting forth on his campaign, and lingered henceforward a futile wreck for a great part of two long and vital years, at the end of which his party and his policy were swept away by the Republican presidential victory of 1920. Europe must be left to stew in its own juice and must pay its lawful debts. At the same time, tariffs were raised to prevent the entry of the goods by which alone these debts could be discharged. At the Washington Conference of 1921, far-reaching proposals for naval disarmament were made by the United States, and the British and American government proceeded to sink their battleships and break up their military establishments with gusto. It was argued in odd logic that it would be immoral to disarm the vanquished unless the victors also stripped themselves of their weapons. The finger of Anglo-American reprobation was presently to be pointed at France, deprived alike of the Rhine frontier and of our treaty guarantee, for maintaining even on a greatly reduced scale a French army based on universal service. And the United States made it clear to Britain that the continuance of her alliance with Japan, to which the Japanese had punctiliously conformed, would constitute a barrier in Anglo-American relations. Accordingly, this alliance was brought to an end. The annulment caused a profound impression in Japan and was viewed as the spurning of an Asiatic power by the Western world. Many links were sundered which might afterwards have proved of decisive value to peace. Thus, both in Europe and in Asia, conditions were swiftly created by the victorious allies, which in the name of peace cleared the way for the renewal of war. While all these untoward events were taking place, amid a ceaseless chatter of well-meant platitudes on both sides of the Atlantic, a new and more terrible cause of quarrel than the imperialism of czars and kaisers became apparent in Europe. The civil war in Russia ended in the absolute victory of the Bolshevik Revolution. Although Marshal Foch wisely observed that Bolshevism had never crossed the frontiers of victory, the foundations of European civilization trembled in the early post-war years. Fascism was the shadow or ugly child of communism. And while Corporal Hitler was making himself useful to the German officer class in Munich by arousing soldiers and workers to fierce hatred of Jews and communists, on whom he laid the blame of Germany's defeat, another adventurer, Benito Mussolini, provided Italy with a new theme of government, which, while it claimed to save the Italian people from communism, raised himself to dictatorial power. Nevertheless, one solid security for peace remained. Germany was disarmed. All her artillery and weapons were destroyed. Her fleet had already sunk itself in Scapa Flow. Her vast army was disbanded. By the Treaty of Versailles, only a professional long service army, not exceeding 100,000 men, and unable on this basis to accumulate reserves, was permitted to Germany for the purposes of internal order. No military air force of any kind was allowed. Submarines were forbidden, and the German Navy was limited to a handful of vessels under 10,000 tons. The French army, resting upon its laurels, was incomparably the strongest military force in Europe, and it was for years believed that the French air force was also of a high order. Up till the year 1934, the power of the conquerors remained unchallenged in Europe, and indeed throughout the world. There was no moment in these 16 years when the three former allies, or even Britain and France, with their associates in Europe, could not, in the name of the League of Nations, and under its moral and international shield, have controlled by a mere effort of the will the armed strength of Germany. Instead, until 1931, the victors, and particularly the United States, concentrated their efforts upon extorting by vexatious foreign control their annual reparations from Germany. The fact that these payments were only made from far larger American loans reduced the whole process to the absurd. Nothing was reaped except ill will. On the other hand, the strict enforcement at any time till 1934 of the disarmament clauses of the peace treaty would have guarded indefinitely, without violence or bloodshed, the peace and safety of mankind. But this was neglected, while the infringements remained petty and shunned as they assumed serious proportions. Thus, the final safeguard of a long peace was cast away. The crimes of the vanquished find their background and their explanation, though not, of course, their pardon, in the follies of the victors. Without these follies, crime would have found neither temptation nor opportunity. I attempt to recount some of the incidents and impressions which form in my mind the story of the coming upon mankind of the worst tragedy in its tumultuous history. When the storm and dust of the cannonade passed suddenly away, the nations, despite their enmities, could still recognize each other as historic racial personalities. The laws of war had on the whole been respected. There was a common professional meeting ground between military and men who had fought one another. Vanquished and victors alike still preserved the semblance of civilized states. A solemn peace was made, which apart from unenforceable financial aspects, conformed to the principles which in the 19th century had increasingly regulated the relations of enlightened peoples. In the Second World War, every bond between man and man was to perish. Crimes were committed by the Germans under the Hitlerite domination to which they allowed themselves to be subjected, the wholesale massacre by systematized processes of 6 or 7 million of men, women, and children. In the German execution camps, the hideous process of bombarding open cities from the air, once started by the Germans, was repaid 20-fold by the ever-mounting power of the Allies and found its culmination in the use of the atomic bomb which obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. After all that we suffered and achieved, we find ourselves still confronted with problems and perils not less but far more formidable than those through which we have so narrowly made our way. It is my purpose, as one who lived and acted in these days, to show how easily the tragedy of the Second World War could have been prevented. how the malice of the wicked was reinforced by the weakness of the virtuous, how the structure and habits of democratic states, unless they are welded into larger organisms, lack those elements of persistence and conviction which can alone give security to humble masses, how even in matters of self-preservation no policy is pursued for even 10 or 15 years at a time. We shall see how the counsels of prudence and restraint may become the prime agents of mortal danger, how the middle course adopted from desires for safety and a quiet life may be found to lead direct to the bull's eye of disaster. We shall see how absolute is the need of a broad path of international action pursued by many states in common across the years, irrespective of the ebb and flow of national politics. When three or four powerful governments acting together have demanded the most fearful sacrifices from their peoples, when these have been given freely for the common cause, and when the longed-for result has been attained, it would seem reasonable that concerted action should be preserved so that at least the essentials would not be cast away. But this modest requirement, the might, civilization, learning, knowledge, science of the victors, were unable to supply. They lived from hand to mouth and from day to day, and went from one election to another, until when scarcely 20 years were out, the dread signal of the Second World War was given. And we must write of the sons of those who had fought and died so faithfully and well. Shoulder to aching shoulder, side by side, they trudged away from life's broad wheels of light.
Chapter 3, Second World War, Lurking Dangers.
In my book, The Aftermath, I have set down the impressions of the 4 years which elapsed between the armistice and a change of government in Britain at the end of 1922. Writing in 1928, I was deeply under the impression of a future catastrophe. I wrote, "It was not until the dawn of the 20th century of the Christian era that war began to enter into its kingdom as the potential destroyer of the human race. All the noblest virtues of individuals were gathered together to strengthen the destructive capacity of the mass. Democratic institutions gave expression to the willpower of millions. Education not only brought the course of the conflict within the comprehension of everyone, but rendered each person serviceable in a high degree for the purpose in hand. The press afforded a means of unification and of mutual stimulation. Religion, having discreetly avoided conflict on the fundamental issues, offered its encouragements and constellations through all its forms, impartially to all the combatants. Lastly, science unfolded her treasures and her secrets to the desperate demands of men, and placed in their hands agencies and apparatus almost decisive in their character. In consequence, many novel features presented themselves. Instead of fortified towns being starved, whole nations were methodically subjected, or sought to be subjected, to the process of reduction by famine. The entire population, in one capacity or another, took part in the war. All were equally the object of attack. The air opened paths along which death and terror could be carried far behind the lines of the actual armies, to women, children, the aged, the sick, who in earlier struggles would perforce have been left untouched. Marvelous organization of railroads, steamships, and motor vehicles placed and maintained tens of millions of men continuously in action. Healing and surgery, in their exquisite developments, returned them again and again to the shambles. Nothing was wasted that could contribute to the process of waste. The last dying kick was brought into military utility. But all that happened in the 4 years of the Great War was only a prelude to what was preparing for the 5th year. The campaign of the year 1919 would have witnessed an immense accession to the powers of destruction. Had the Germans retained the morale to make good their retreat to the Rhine, thousands of airplanes would have shattered their cities. Scores of thousands of cannon would have blasted their front. Arrangements were being made to carry simultaneously 250,000 men, together with all their requirements, continuously forward across country in mechanical vehicles moving 10 or 15 miles each day. Poison gases of incredible malignity, against which only a secret mask, which the Germans could not obtain in time, were proof. These would have stifled all resistance and paralyzed all life on the hostile front subjected to attack. No doubt the Germans, too, had their plans. But the hour of wrath had passed. The signal of relief was given, and the horrors of 1919 remained buried in the archives of the great antagonists. The war stopped as suddenly and as universally as it had begun. The world lifted its head, surveyed the scene of ruin, and victors and vanquished alike drew breath. In 100 laboratories, in 1,000 arsenals, factories and bureaus, men pulled themselves up with a jerk and turned from the task in which they had been absorbed. Their projects were put aside, unfinished, unexecuted. But their knowledge was preserved. Their data, calculations, and discoveries were hastily bundled together and docketed for future reference by the war offices in every country. The campaign of 1919 was never fought, but its ideas go marching along. In every army they are being explored, elaborated, refined under the surface of peace. And should war come again to the world, it is not with the weapons and agencies prepared for 1919 that it will be fought, but with developments and extensions of these, which will be incomparably more formidable and fatal. It is in these circumstances that we entered upon that period of exhaustion which has been described as peace. It gives us at any rate an opportunity to consider the general situation. Certain somber facts emerge, solid, inexorable, like the shapes of mountains from drifting mist. It is established that henceforward whole populations will take part in war, all doing their utmost, all subjected to the fury of the enemy. It is established that nations who believe their life is at stake will not be restrained from using any means to secure their existence. It is probable, nay certain, that among the means which will next time be at their disposal will be agencies and processes of destruction, wholesale, unlimited, and perhaps, once launched, uncontrollable. Mankind has never been in this position before, without having improved appreciably in virtue or enjoying wiser guidance. It has got into its hands for the first time the tools by which it can unfailingly accomplish its own extermination. That is the point in human destinies to which all the glories and toils of men have at last led them. They would do well to pause and ponder upon their new responsibilities. Death stands at attention, obedient, expectant, ready to serve, ready to shear away the peoples en masse, ready, if called on, to pulverize without hope of repair what is left of civilization. He awaits only the word of command. He awaits it from a frail, bewildered being, long his victim, now, for one occasion only, his master. All this was published on January the 1st, 1929. Now, on another New Year's Day, 18 years later, I could not write it differently. All the words and actions for which I am accountable between the wars had as their object only the prevention of a Second World War, and of course of making sure that if the worst happened, we won, or at least survived. There can hardly ever have been a war more easy to prevent than this Second Armageddon. I've always been ready to use force in order to defy tyranny or ward off ruin. But had our British, American, and Allied affairs been conducted with the ordinary consistency and common sense usual in decent households, there was no need for force to march unaccompanied by law. And strength, moreover, could have been used in righteous causes with little risk of bloodshed. in their loss of purpose, in their abandonment even of the themes they most sincerely espoused, Britain, France, and most of all, because of their immense power and impartiality, the United States, allowed conditions to be gradually built up, which led to the very climax they dreaded most. They have only to repeat the same well-meaning, short-sighted behavior towards the new problems which in singular resemblance confront us today to bring about a third convulsion from which none may live to tell the tale. I had written even earlier, in 1925, some thoughts and queries of a technical character, which it would be wrong to omit in these days. May there not be methods of using explosive energy, incomparably more intense than anything heretofore discovered? Might not a bomb no bigger than an orange be found to possess a secret power to destroy a whole block of buildings, nay, to concentrate the force of 1,000 tons of cordite and blast the township at a stroke? Could not explosives even of the existing type be guided automatically in flying machines by wireless or other rays without a human pilot in ceaseless procession upon a hostile city, arsenal, camp, or dockyard? As for poison gas and chemical warfare in all its forms, only the first chapter has been written of a terrible book. Certainly every one of these new avenues to destruction is being studied on both sides of the Rhine with all the science and patience of which man is capable. And why should it be supposed that these resources will be limited to inorganic chemistry? A study of disease, of pestilence, is methodically prepared and deliberately launched upon man and beast. It is certainly being pursued in the laboratories of more than one great country. Blight to destroy crops, anthrax to slay horses and cattle, plague to poison not armies only, but whole districts. Such are the lines on which military science is remorselessly advancing. All this is nearly a quarter of a century old. It is natural that a proud people, vanquished in war, should strive to rearm themselves as soon as possible. The responsibility, therefore, of enforcing a continual state of military disarmament upon a beaten foe rests upon the victors. For this purpose, they must pursue a twofold policy. First, while remaining sufficiently armed themselves, they must enforce with tireless vigilance and authority the clauses of the treaty which forbid the revival of their late antagonists' military power. Secondly, they should do all that is possible to reconcile the defeated nation to its lot by acts of benevolence designed to procure the greatest amount of prosperity in the beaten country, and labor by every means to create a basis of true friendship and of common interests, so that the incentive to appeal again to arms will be continually diminished. In these years, I coined the maxim, the redress of the grievances of the vanquished should precede the disarmament of the victors. As will be seen, the reverse process was to a large extent followed by Britain, the United States, and France.
Chapter 4, Second World War, Adolf Hitler.
In October 1918, a German corporal had been temporarily blinded by chlorine gas in a British attack near Comines. While he lay in hospital in Pomerania, defeat and revolution swept over Germany. The son of an obscure Austrian customs official, he had nursed youthful dreams of becoming a great artist. Having failed to gain entry to the Academy of Art in Vienna, he had lived in poverty in that capital and later in Munich. Sometimes as a house painter, often as a casual laborer, he suffered physical privations and bred a harsh, though concealed, resentment that the world had denied him success. These misfortunes did not lead him into communist ranks. By an honorable inversion, he cherished all the more an abnormal sense of racial loyalty and a fervent and mystic admiration for Germany and the German people. He sprang eagerly to arms at the outbreak of the war, and served for 4 years with a Bavarian regiment on the Western Front. Such were the early fortunes of Adolf Hitler. As he lay sightless and helpless in hospital during the winter of 1918, his own personal failure seemed merged in the disaster of the whole German people. The shock of defeat, the collapse of law and order, the triumph of the French, caused this convalescent regimental orderly an agony which consumed his being and generated those portentous and measureless forces of the spirit which may spell the rescue or the doom of mankind. The downfall of Germany seemed to him inextricable by ordinary processes. Somewhere there had been a gigantic and monstrous betrayal. Lonely and pent within himself, the little soldier pondered and speculated upon the possible causes of the catastrophe, guided only by his narrow personal experiences. He had mingled in Vienna with extreme German nationalist groups, and here he had heard stories of sinister undermining activities of another race, foes and exploiters of the Nordic world, the Jews. His patriotic anger fused with his envy of the rich and successful into one overpowering hate. When at length, as an unnoted patient, he was released from hospital, still wearing the uniform, in which he had an almost schoolboyish pride, what scenes met his newly unscaled eyes? Fearful are the convulsions of defeat. Around him in the atmosphere of despair and frenzy glared the lineaments of red revolution. Armored cars dashed through the streets of Munich, scattering leaflets or bullets upon the fugitive wayfarers. His own comrades, with defiant red armbands on their uniform, were shouting slogans of fury against all that he cared for on earth. As in a dream, everything suddenly became clear. Germany had been stabbed in the back and clawed down by the Jews, by the profiteers and intriguers behind the front, by the accursed Bolsheviks in their international conspiracy of Jewish intellectuals. Shining before him, he saw his duty to save Germany from these plagues, to avenge her wrongs, and lead the master race to their long-decreed destiny. The officers of his regiment, deeply alarmed by the seditious and revolutionary temper of their men, were very glad to find one, at any rate, who seemed to have the root of the matter in him. Corporal Hitler desired to remain mobilized and found employment as a political education officer or agent. In this guise, he gathered information about mutinous and subversive designs. Presently, he was told by the security officer for whom he worked to attend meetings of the local political parties of all complexions. One evening in September 1919, the corporal went to a rally of the German Workers' Party in a Munich brewery, and here he heard for the first time people talking in the style of his secret convictions against the Jews, the speculators, the November criminals who had brought Germany into the abyss. On September 16, he joined this party, and shortly afterwards, in harmony with his military work, undertook its propaganda. In February 1920, the first mass meeting of the German Workers' Party was held in Munich. And here Adolf Hitler himself dominated the proceedings and in 25 points outlined the party program. He had now become a politician. His campaign of national salvation had been opened. In April he was demobilized and the expansion of the party absorbed his whole life. By the middle of the following year he had ousted the original leaders and by his passion and genius forced upon the hypnotized company the acceptance of his personal control. Already he was the Führer. An unsuccessful newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, was bought as the party organ. The communists were not long in recognizing their foe. They tried to break up Hitler's meetings, and in the closing days of 1921, he organized his first units of stormtroopers. Up to this point, all had moved in local circles in Bavaria. But in the tribulation of German life during these first post-war years, many began here and there throughout the Reich to listen to the new gospel. The fierce anger of all Germany at the French occupation of the Ruhr in 1923 brought what was now called the National Socialist Party a broad wave of adherents. The collapse of the Mark destroyed the basis of the German middle class, of whom many in their despair became recruits of the new party and found relief from their misery in hatred, vengeance, and patriotic fervor. At the beginning, Hitler had made it clear that the path to power lay through aggression and violence against a Weimar Republic born from the shame of defeat. By November 1923, the Führer had a determined group around him, among whom Goering, Hess, Rosenberg, and Röhm were prominent. These men of action decided that the moment had come to attempt the seizure of authority in the state of Bavaria. General von Ludendorff lent the military prestige of his name to the venture and marched forward in the putsch. It used to be said before the war, in Germany there will be no revolution, because in Germany all revolutions are strictly forbidden. This precept was revived on this occasion by the local authorities in Munich. The priests, troops fired, carefully avoiding the general, who marched straight forward into their ranks and was received with respect. About 20 of the demonstrators were killed. Hitler threw himself upon the ground and presently escaped with other leaders from the scene. In April 1924, he was sentenced to 4 years' imprisonment. Although the German authorities had maintained order and the German court had inflicted punishment, the feeling was widespread throughout the land that they were striking at their own flesh and blood and were playing the foreigner game at the expense of Germany's most faithful sons. Hitler's sentence was reduced from 4 years to 13 months. These months in the Landsberg fortress were, however, sufficient to enable him to complete, in outline, Mein Kampf, a treatise on his political philosophy inscribed to the dead of the recent putsch. When eventually he came to power, there was no book which deserved more careful study from the rulers, political and military, of the Allied powers. All went there. The program of German resurrection, the technique of party propaganda, the plan for combating Marxism, the concept of a national socialist state, the rightful position of Germany at the summit of the world. Here was the new Quran of faith and war, turgid, verbose, shapeless, but pregnant with its message. The main thesis of Mein Kampf is simple. Man is a fighting animal. Therefore, the nation, being a community of fighters, is a fighting unit. Any living organism which ceases to fight for its existence is doomed to extinction. A country or a race which ceases to fight is equally doomed. The fighting capacity of a race depends on its purity. Hence the need for ridding it of foreign defilements. The Jewish race, owing to its universality, is of necessity pacifist and internationalist. Pacifism is the deadliest sin, for it means the surrender of the race in the fight for existence. The first duty of every country is, therefore, to nationalize the masses. Intelligence, in the case of the individual, is not of first importance. Will and determination are prime qualities. The individual who is born to command is more valuable than countless thousands of subordinate nature. Only brute force can ensure the survival of the race, hence the necessity for military forms. The race must fight. A race that rests must rust and perish. Had the German race been united in good time, it would have been already master of the globe. The new Reich must gather within its fold all the scattered German elements in Europe. A race which has suffered defeat can be rescued by restoring its self-confidence. Above all things, the army must be taught to believe in its own invincibility. To restore the German nation, the people must be convinced that the recovery of freedom by force of arms is possible. The aristocratic principle is fundamentally sound. Intellectualism is undesirable. The ultimate aim of education is to produce a German who can be converted with the minimum of training into a soldier. The greatest upheavals in history would have been unthinkable had it not been for the driving force of fanatical and hysterical passions. Nothing could have been effected by the bourgeois virtues of peace and order. The world is now moving towards such an upheaval, and the new German state must see to it that the race is ready for the last and greatest decisions on this earth. Foreign policy may be unscrupulous. It is not the task of diplomacy to allow a nation to founder heroically, but rather to see that it can prosper and survive. England and Italy are the only two possible allies for Germany. No country will enter into an alliance with a cowardly pacifist state run by Democrats and Marxists. So long as Germany does not fend for herself, nobody will fend for her. Her lost promises cannot be regained by solemn appeals to heaven, or by pious hopes in the League of Nations, but only by force of arms. Germany must not repeat the mistake of fighting all our enemies at once. She must single out the most dangerous and attack him with all her forces. The world will only cease to be anti-German when Germany recovers equality of rights and resumes her place in the sun. There must be no sentimentality about Germany's foreign policy. To attack France for purely sentimental reasons would be foolish. What Germany needs is increase of territory in Europe. Germany's pre-war colonial policy was a mistake and should be abandoned. Germany must look for expansion to Russia, and especially to the Baltic states. No alliance with Russia can be tolerated. To wage war together with Russia against the West would be criminal, for the aim of the Soviets is the triumph of international Judaism. Such were the granite pillars of his politics.